The Holy Gospel according to St. Matthew, the 24th chapter.
Glory to you, O Lord.
But about that day and hour, no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. For as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away. So too will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two will be in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, one will be taken and one will be left. Keep awake, therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But understand this: if the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ.
The story goes that Andy Reid, the coach of the Philadelphia Eagles, had finished his earthly journey and had entered into heaven to be greeted by St. Peter at the pearly gates. And St. Peter said, "Before I show you where you're going to be spending eternity, let me take you on a quick tour of heaven." And so they went by this beautiful house, and in front of the house were all of the flags for the what's that team from New England? The Patriots, that's right. And Andy Reid said, "So who lives there?" And St. Peter said, "Well, that's where Bill Belichick is going to live." So they got this beautiful tour of heaven, and they come up to this wonderful house, large, beautiful, wonderful landscape, a pool in the back, and on the front are the Philadelphia Eagles colors and flags, and Andy said, "Whose house is this?" And St. Peter said, "This is going to be your house, so take a good look at it." So Andy Reid is looking all around and how beautiful his house is, and feeling that he has lived a good life, is being rewarded for his life. He can settle down now in eternity. And out of the corner of his eye, he sees this huge, huge castle. And flying in front of the castle are the black and gold colors, with the Pittsburgh Steelers flags flying on it. And Andy gets worked up. He says, "Why is it that Larry Tomlin gets a nicer house than me?" Well, St. Peter's taken aback for a second, and then he sees where Andy Reid is looking. He goes, "Oh, no, no, that's not Larry Tomlin's house. That's where God lives." Visions of heaven. We all have those visions of heaven that might be rooted in what we learned in Sunday school or what we hope heaven might be. They might be rooted in a desire for a break from what we're encountering at this moment in our lives. It might be a yearning that the anxiety goes away, or that the fear stops, or that the heartache is finally mended. For the Christian community, the resurrection of Jesus is that pivotal moment that makes something extraordinary possible for all of creation. What we're going to take a look at today as we look at resurrection is, first of all, how resurrection challenges all that strives to negate our lives. Second, we're going to take a look at what Jesus' resurrection really accomplishes. And finally, we're going to dare to make the claim that we are at this moment already living resurrection lives. For all that negates, we have something in the life of the church, especially as Lutherans of the Reformation tradition, called doctrine. And most of us, when we hear doctrine, think of this heady theological language that we don't quite understand, but we have been taught is important that we have to buy into. Think of doctrine in this way. Doctrine is how the church has taught the followers of Jesus to understand what God is doing in the world. It's how the church teaches what God is doing. And that teaching many times is rooted in real life experiences of God's people. What God's people from the beginning of time have encountered are the powers and principalities of this world that negate human life. People have faced their own deaths or the death of a loved one. They've seen the power of death to negate that sense of life and vitality. People have invested in what they believe to have been true and what they have believed to be right and life-changing, and that death negates all that is right and all that is truthful. But God's people, in the midst of everything that negates who they are, have believed that what God does changes that power of negation. And it's the doctrine of the resurrection, of how the church speaks to people whose lives are being undone and says that it is God's will that will finally be done in human life. We in this day encounter powers of negation. Those voices that tell us things are going to fall apart. We hear it from tyrants like the head of North Korea, who can flex his military muscle and cause anger and fear in South Korea. And isn't it always fascinating when the bully strikes, the people fight with each other instead of standing up with the bully? We see that power of negation when people are gathering in Oregon to light that Christmas tree, the symbol of hope and the possibility of light in this darkest season of the year. And someone wants to take as many lives as possible. But we also see it as we are confronted with difficult decisions in our own lives. What we desire is that every decision we face will have a right and good and easy answer and then the answer that is wrong, so it will make it clear to us which way we should go. But as we find in our own situations in life, many times neither solution is the preferred solution. I can remember the mother coming to me years ago, living with an emotionally abusive husband, who knew that if she stayed in that relationship, that she would lose her very soul. But at the same time, if she left and took all three children with her, they had no place to live, no money to survive on, and it put her children at risk. There was no easy solution in that situation. And I have to admit that when I think about death, I don't really think about my own death and how it impacts me. I sort of see it through the lens of someone who's a bit more self-serving, that I think about my death and I think, how is my wife going to survive without me? She might actually have a whoop and a holler of joy at that point. Or I think, what will my son do without me? All of those voices that negate who we are and the value of our lives. Brothers and sisters, God's will be accomplished and overturn every voice that negates who we are. That happens as we focus upon the resurrection of Jesus. It's fascinating to see how in Jewish thought and then into Christian thought we have evolved into something that we call heaven. The earliest beliefs of the Jewish people were that God's justice would be done, that those who were wrong will be vindicated, those who were doing wrong will be judged. But what God's people found over time is that justice wasn't always happening immediately. They yearned for an immediate resolution that wasn't there, and so it took the place of the prophets and the judges to say, in time, God's will be done and justice will be served. And so people would yearn for in their lifetime that justice will be established. But even in their lifetimes, they were finding that righteousness did not rule the earth. And so they came to say, at some time, the new age will come about. And it was the Messiah, the chosen one of God, who would bring about that new age. When we see the resurrection of Jesus, what we see in the resurrection of Jesus is that Jesus has been named that Messiah. And through him, the new age begins. You see, resurrection existed prior to Jesus being raised from the dead. We see times of Jesus raising people from the dead prior to his own. The difference is Jesus is raised as the Messiah, the Son of God, who brings about this new age. And it's a new age that we heard about from Isaiah today, where swords are beat into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks, and nation shall not lift sword against nation, neither shall anyone learn war anymore. Jesus brings about that new age. My son, this holiday season, has discovered the Home Alone series with Macaulay Culkin, who is this young boy, Kevin McAllister, who in the first one gets left at home when his family flies to France and leaves him behind. And, you know, we have to admit that as parents, if we had younger boys who acted like Kevin did in the movie, we've been tempted to leave them behind on our family trips so we can resonate with those parents at some level. In the second of the series, Macaulay Culkin is in New York by himself. And in both of those series, these two bungling burglars, in the first trying to break into his house. And so what Kevin does is he lays a series of traps in the house. So as they try to get in, they're slipping down the steps into ice and falling and hurting themselves. He heats up the door handle and burns the hand of the one crook, and so he's permanently scarred on his hand, and all kinds of feathers being blown in their faces and their feet being cut with Christmas ornaments. And finally, at the end, the burglars are caught because they get hit over the head with the neighbor with a snow shovel. The police come to arrest them, and Kevin is in his window watching these thieves being arrested. And all the way into the squad car, they are ranting and raving and saying, "We're going to get you. We're going to get you. We're going to get you, you miserable kid." And he smiles. Because as much as they threaten him, they no longer have power over him. As much as the world threatens us, because Jesus has been raised from the dead, it no longer has power over us. The voices can rage and yell and cut at us, but they no longer have the final word. That resurrection power is active right now in this world. Years ago, when the Left Behind book series came out, a parishioner handed me the first of the series and asked me to start reading it because she wanted my opinions on it. So I started reading the first book, and I have to admit that I got to the part where they're flying in the airplane, and all of a sudden half of the people disappear and the other half are left behind in the airplane. And the image that the author puts at that point is at the close of all of those who have been taken is still on the seats of the airplane. And for a while, it almost caused me to give up my notion of heaven, because if heaven is a bunch of people in airplanes are running around naked, I'm not sure that I want to be there. You've seen people on airplanes, is that right? But it picks up on this notion that the good will be plucked away and the evil will be left behind. But look closely at the gospel text today, because we think that the gospel text supports that conclusion where Jesus says here that two will be in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two will be grinding meal together, one will be taken and one will be left. But notice how Jesus introduces that concept. As in the days of Noah, people were going about their daily lives until Noah went into the ark and the flood came along. Who was left behind in the story of Noah? The good and the righteous were the ones left behind. Those who were evil were the ones washed away. Perhaps then we don't want to be the ones taken away. We want to be the ones remaining behind. It's a metaphor. And what that text is striving to show to Christians is that God's power is a power that is active on earth. the resurrection power is changing things on earth. As Paul picks up in his resurrection theology, that as people die and they go into the eternal rest of the Father, there will come a time when the trumpet shall sound and the dead will be raised and the earth will be restored. The very final act of God happens here in this creation. And that's what we're waiting for. We're waiting for it because it's already started to happen. Now here's the challenge we face. In Matthew's community, they were at first believing that Jesus' return was going to be immediate. As it wasn't immediate, they started to push it out longer and longer. We still have the challenge of immediacy in our own culture, but in a different way. We want the solutions. We want everything to be made right when? Now. And so we are attracted to the quick fixes, the things that help us hope, and to put our trust in them. My wife loves the fact, as I shared with many of you before, that the way that I cope and settle my own anxiety is by cleaning the house and doing laundry and making the beds. And so she actually loves when my life is full of anxiety because the house looks great right after that. So the other day, I'm taking the sheets off the bed, putting new sheets on, and she comes up and she says to me, "Can I help?" And I said, "No." She got a smile on her face, and I said, "Being in a calling where very few things are immediate responses, I like to do things that I can see an immediate result." It is soothing, and there's nothing wrong with that, but we are caught in an age of socially acceptable addictions. We know about addictions to alcohol and drugs and to different forms of sexual activity, and we are pretty comfortable in saying they're harmful, but there are a whole series of socially acceptable addictions out there. That is, things that on the surface appear to be functional and good, but in real life are causing harm to others. So after I made that bed, and it was perfectly stretched out, and there was not a wrinkle in the comforter, my son comes bounding into the bedroom, and you know what he does? Cannonball! I snapped at him because he undid my perfect world. Children do that, don't they? My wife comes home from the grocery store, everything fully stocked, a new bottle of peanut butter in the pantry, and my son decides he's hungry. "Can I have a peanut butter sandwich?" "No." "Why not?" "I just bought that bottle of peanut butter. I don't want to disturb it yet." I have to admit that after I vacuum the carpet, I don't like to see footsteps on the carpet. You can certainly laugh at the idiosyncrasies of my family. Think about your own. What helps you make sense of the world? What helps build you up and strengthen you? Is it the power of Jesus' resurrection? The power of Jesus' resurrection says this: it is now the end of the world as we know it. And something new is starting to happen. Watch. Wake up. Listen. And pay attention for it. Amen.